Welcome to Ruby Ray, real and raw conversations for the rising global woman. I am your host, Jacqueline Norton. Today, I'm speaking with Anaya Sophia. She shares a fascinating story about the 700th year, the last Cathar, and this prophecy of the 700 years. And so Anaya is an author and a mystic, and she's also the chatelaine in Lacan in the French Pyrenees. And so she is living in this place that holds very, very deep history and wisdom, secrets and codes. And in this land, it's where the real fortress, the stronghold of the Cathars and the Templars and the Troubadours and Mary Magdalene. And so there's so much that's still very alive within this region of the earth. And a lot of these stories that are, as we know, coming back to be heard and to be told and to be known again. And so the story that we're telling today specifically, or that Anaya is telling today, is the one of the 700th year, the prophecy of the 700th year, what that means for us now and how that story relates to the time that we're living in now and can maybe act as a lighthouse or a guidepost for us to contextualize this time period, this moment of time that we're living in, which I know can seem difficult sometimes to think that big picture of things because it's easy to get caught up in our day-to-day, in our life, in our routines. But stories like this really bring me back to the vastness of this world and this universe and these stories that can weave these threads through time and connect us to different time periods and regions and belief systems and cultures. And we also talk about being drawn spiritually and romantically, historically, essentially to an area where we feel that primal draw, that primal pull to a place. It might not necessarily be to a place that our ancestors are from or our lineage is from, but our soul knows it. Our soul recognizes it and our soul yearns for it. And we also talk about the Cathars as the spiritual ancestors of Mary Magdalene and Lecomte, where she is now, the difference between the Cathars and the Templars and the Troubadours and the connection between the Templars and Our Lady of Notre Dame and the esoteric romance that was just so alive in this region of the world and what that aliveness looked like, what they were devoted to, what they loved, what they gave their lives to, and what the Cathar woman was like, the high priestess of the Cathar faith, and the deeper gnosis of their customs, like the kiss of peace and the feet washing and the order of the dove we discuss as well. And so there's just that combination of history and mystery and mysticism, and where does one end and the other begin, and that eternal curiosity and questioning. It's a real gift to be able to receive this story and this mystery through Anaya and through her own way that she captures and tells the story. And if you would like to get in touch with her, you can find her on Facebook at Anaya Sophia, A-N-A-I-Y-A, Sophia, S-O-P-H-I-A. You can also find her at anayasophia.com. And if you are around on New Year's Eve and you don't have plans or you will be free, then she is offering a free New Year's Eve Mass at Notre Dame Sophia. So this starts on New Year's Eve. She'll be streaming live from the Notre Dame de Sophia. It's been a full year. It has been a magical year in many ways, and a year that really pushed us deeper and expanded us further. And there's just so much to be grateful for through it all. And I hope that through this holiday season, you're finding some moments of stillness and silence silence and peace for yourself. I know that this time of year can get very noisy and busy and loud with the consumerism and the capitalistic world and the needing to be here and there and plans and family and all of the things that the holiday brings, which is, it can be so special and it can also be a distraction. So I hope that you're able to find that place of stillness in these last few days of the year, because this is a time that's just so gifting us the opportunity for reflection and slowing down. And there's so much wisdom in that. There's so much that the silence says when we listen to it. That's really, to me, the magic of this time, on the opposite end of the spectrum from the busyness and the plans and the things to do. It's also that invitation for a deeper stillness and slowness and silence with ourselves, and really being reflective and intentional about where we've been this year and where we're going and what we're choosing to create for this next year, and the limitlessness that being the creators of our lives offers to us. Wishing you all a very merry end of 2022 into 2023. And I love you all so much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Yeah, I'm gonna enjoy this time together as well.
Yes, I'm so excited. I'm so glad that we made this work out. And I'm really curious about what your story is in coming to Le Conte in France, and how did you find it, or it find you, and what was the story of coming to this place?
I can remember a very distinct moment in 2002 where I was on the beach in Brighton, which is one of our most coolest cities in the UK on the south coast. And I was writing away in my journal, and I got the feeling, rather than hearing, I got the feeling that there was a very loving, sensual, ancient female talking within, but not talking, not listening, the feel of her speaking. And it literally said, "If you want to know me, come to France." My idea of going to France was not exactly, I wasn't like jumping up going, "Oh yeah, yippee, brilliant, can't wait." To me, France was like, what's there? You know, it's the neighboring country. I had my eyes set much further afield, like Bali or Australia. But nevertheless, I made a note, and sure enough, within about 10 days, I was asked to drop in as the yoga teacher for a retreat in France. And it was this region. So it was the French Pyrenees, the southwest corner, Cathar land, basically. But I didn't know anything about this. And when arriving within 10 minutes of actually landing on the ground here in Carcassonne, oh gosh, I was flooded and swamped with more of that female presence. It was as if I was reliving this female's life. I had no clue. It was what I would one day come to call Mary Magdalene, or at least, you know, my interpretation of her. And so that started off a 25-year period of exploring and reading and talking. Actually, coming here at Le Conte, if you see a picture of it, you'll probably stagger backwards going, "What?" Because it's an old Colonie de Vacances. It's an old summer schoolhouse for at least 300 children. It is enormous. It's like a village rather than a house. And it's got a spring, and it's got a chapel, and it's got caves, and it's got a mountain, and it's got a labyrinth. It just keeps going on. Basically, it was my mother and father's gift to me. That's how I actually came to have it. My dad was close to death. He's passed now. So he arranged for it, for my inheritance, basically, because I'm a single child. So he arranged for my inheritance to come to me just weeks before he passed over. He wanted to see that moment when I could accept the house. And He got to see it. He got to hear it. He got to know it is done. And so my whole life, even my interior life, has changed 180 degrees. Because living here changes everything. Whatever I had going on the inside has been scrubbed clean, and the up-leveled version of that has come forward. It's very challenging to be here. I have to expand. I have to learn a lot about boundaries and being, you know, the chatelaine or the custodian. There's a lot to protect here, so I have to make sure my T's are crossed and my I's are dotted. So it's a full-on initiation and daily challenged on.
Wow. So how did you find the schoolhouse? How did you find Le Camp, and what condition was it in when you found it in? Do you have ancestral lineage in France? How did this all come to be?
I guess I have spiritual ancestors here, totally devoted to Mary's time here. We know Mary Magdalene was here. That's pretty factual. The Cathars, you know, the spiritual ancestors of Mary, you could say. So I'm drawn romantically, historically, spiritually, sensually to this area. But no, I'm not French. And I've got no technical French blood ancestors. I've always known of Le Camp because of the size, and it's on the way to Château de Montségur, which is the last Cathar fortress. So anyone who knows this region will know this road and know this house, because it's the last house before you reach the chateau, the climb to the chateau. So I knew about it, and I knew it had connections to Mary Magdalene and the spring, and the people who lived here previously were holding Magdalene festivals here in the 90s. So, you know, I was aware, like all of us who live here, aware of this great big house. One day, Peter and I were just randomly walking, and we got speaking to the man who was doing a bit of gardening, and he explained that it was for sale. And Pete gave me a nudge, and I just went, because I'd been here, I'd looked around, you know, in previous events. I knew how massive this was. I knew how ginormous this was, and that it was a leap from our little stone cottage that we were living in to this mama of a property. He was saying, this is the one. This is the one. It's got a chapel. It's got a spring. He just listed all these things that I'd be interested in. And his side of things, he wanted land. He wanted permaculture. He wanted to make a food forest. So we put our property on the market. Now, it's a slow process to buy and sell in this corner of France. So that's where my parents came in. It was the start of the pandemic. They were living in England. They wanted to be with me in France to go through this together, because we all sensed this isn't going to be a quickie. This is a long journey. And me, Mum and Dad, we're so close. So they come to France, they saw what we were interested in, they gave us the go-ahead, which I didn't think for one minute they would. They would just say, oh, it's ridiculous. So Dad got fully behind it and said, I will buy it for you until you sell your other house.
And how does it feel now being there and being on that land and being on that land in a time where so many of our collective memories are coming back online and getting reactivated? And this is the land that you are in, is such sacred ground.
It feels like everything, every person, every love, every heartbreak, every challenge, all forms of education, 3D education, spiritual education, it was all leading to this place. Now I realize I am here. I'm not traveling. I'm not going anywhere. This is Forever House. And Dad, you know, when he passed, he was cremated, and half of him is in the chapel as ashes, and half of him has been plowed into the summer, into the flower garden. Now, I know mum's going to take the same route, and I know I'm going to take the same route. So technically, we have become part of the land.
And you mentioned the spring there, and springs are so, they're the first thing that was ever revered or worshipped or considered holy. If we go way, 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 way back, and they carry like such deep currents, especially of the feminine and of healing. And what are those waters like to you there, the spring waters?
It's a huge, huge spring. It's more of a pool. You could easily get 20 people in the spring all at once. Huge amounts of volume come through all year round, every single day. And it's coming from what's known as the Cathar Holy Mountain, which is Mount Sularak. So it literally pops up there for the very first time, close to the summit. It comes down and goes into what's called the Pog of Château de Montségur, which is not quite a hill and not quite a mountain. So it disappears in the bottom and turns into a subterranean river. And then, you know, a kilometer or two along the road in our place. So, you know, those of us really into the Cathar legacy and prophecy are saying, oh my God, its origins are the Cathar Holy Mountain. It feeds Château de Montségur. You know, all of that blood that was spilt there, the 225 Cathars, is most definitely informing, corresponding with this water. It goes underground and deep and lays low for a while, and then it comes up at the back of LeConte. So that is big. That is big for people.
It is big. And we, you know, have seen the different scientific studies and things like that about how water holds memory, how the molecules are so adaptable. They're so moldable. And so to be in that region with that history, and you can only imagine the memories that the water is still holding to this day. And the fact that we are mostly water, and so interacting with that, the influence that it has on ourselves and in our entire being.
Yes, there is a lady in Ireland, I believe she's Nigerian. She calls herself Christelle Ariel, and she is a seer and an oracle. And she was saying, this place out the back is a library. Just like it has a connection with Alexandria and has a connection with Qumran. Qumran was a library, just like Alexandria, real books. That's why the Nag Hammadi was discovered there. It's not random. It was a library. It was a huge, vast archive of scrolls, papyrus, texts, manuscripts. And that this water is also a library. If you drink it, if you bathe in it, that's how you read the information.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think about even just sometimes when I shower and the downloads or, you know, what can open up just through interacting with water. And I can't even imagine what it would be like in that spring. So would you be willing to give us a little history lesson about the Cathar legacy, prophecy, influence? I know that this is either 2021 or 2022 was the 700th year. So can you explain to us what this means and why it's so significant to the times that we're living in now?
Well, indeed, it was 2021. And the last Cathar was known as Guillaume Bellebust. He didn't realize he was the last Cathar. I always have the impression that he was a kind of bohemian, artistic. We know he loved the ladies. We know he enjoyed having a little drink. He was an artist, but he had a pure heart, and his heart held the calling. So he asked to become a parfait, and he went through the training, and he came out, and he was a parfait. But he always felt, I'm not really as pure as the other ones. He gave the consolamentum, he gave the healings, he held the masses, he did it all. But he himself perhaps felt like he wasn't worthy. So after a while, he kind of veered off and went back to his old life, but still did his Cathar work for the people, the local people. He took on a lady friend and he wanted to marry. And as a parfait, you're not really supposed to marry. So at that point, he said, well, you know what? I'm going to hand myself in. If I cannot marry this lady, if I cannot shake off the oaths I've taken, then I'm just going to reject them. I'm going to step out of it. So he handed himself in at least 50 years after the main crusade. He didn't think anything of it. He then realized he was the last one and that he had been hunted for by spies and anyone who was willing to seek him out, because there was a bounty on his head. So when he realized he was the last one, I always have this feeling that what was passed to him blazed open, because this is his moment now. And he fully accepted and owned the fact he is a parfait. He has every right to be a parfait, and he wasn't going to be released. So he couldn't release his vow. He now realizes, oh my gosh, he's going to be burnt at the stake, because he hasn't been forgotten. And so he was aflame that day, literally, when he was burnt at the stake. He was cheerful. He was joyful. He had tears coming down from his eyes because he was in prayer. And just as the flames started to lick around his feet, it was as if he was receiving something, kept looking up at the sky. This is all noted in the Inquisition notes. And he came down and gazed upon everyone who was present. And that's when he uttered the prophecy, which was, in 700 years, when the laurel turns green, we shall return. And there was smiles, and there was tears, and there was joy, and there was suffering, but there was joy.
Wow, my whole body just got chills when you said that. Oh my goodness. Wow. So here we are, 700 years later.
Yes. And look where we are. Look what's gathering. To me, this moment, it's similar, if not the same, energy.
And how would you describe this energy?
Well, I personally would say the Vatican and the Crusaders and this, renounce your faith and step into our religion, and what you're doing is wrong, and you are a heretic, and we shall have to take your life for doing something different. Heretic means to choose. Well, to me, it is like the COVID vaccine. That's my opinion. That's the path I have taken. It's a similar kind of energy. The taking away of rights, the sense of being hunted. You guys can't come in here because you don't have your pass. And now look at Canada with the Freedom Convoy. It's just going to the next level every time and every time. So to me, that's the modern day crusade. I love the fact that it means to choose. And some of us are choosing not to. That makes us a heretic again.
I think we've been going through this for a while now. It's been a couple of years, and we've all gone through such inner journeys. We're following what's happening in the outer world, but really the transformation for a lot of us is going into our depths and alchemizing from within. But it can also be numbing and tiring and exhausting at times, because we've all had relationships change and livelihoods change and so many different layers of our lives affected. And so just to come back to this knowingness and this acknowledgement of where we are in history, and not just in this now moment, but how it relates to the span of history before us and the significance of it. And like what you were saying before about maybe the ancestral bloodline isn't there, but our spiritual bloodline is. And I think for so many of us, our spiritual bloodline is coming back online, and we're remembering why we're here and the lives that we've lived before and our mission in this lifetime. And you can feel like the gravity of it. You can feel the weight of it. And it can feel like a lot to hold sometimes and a lot to live in that place of that knowingness when there's so much in the outside world to distract us and to pull us away. And I love what you said about the heretic, the choice, the chooser, because a chosen one is the one who chooses. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All that means is we're choosing. And what are we choosing? And in this moment, what are we choosing? And, you know, we're living through a time where these choices that are presented to us are really enormous. And they may be made to seem like they're not, but they are. And it does feel kind of like a full circle moment.
It's as if, you know, in the past, it was the battle for the soul. And now it seems it's the battle for the body. And it's mostly the spiritual ones who are fighting for the body. And I just think that's beautiful. Because one of the spiritual bypasses is to leave behind the body, to transcend the body, to starve it, to purify it. Quite harsh treatment. But the fact that we're saying, hey, some of us are saying, hey, no, do not touch my body. And we're going to fight for our body. I just say, yeah, that's beautiful.
Me too. Totally. It is. And I mean, the real awakening happens in the body. And I know that you are a mover and dancer, and I am as well. And how has that embodiment practice and dance practice and, you know, changed you? Because for me, at the beginning of all of this lockdown, I was having this daily yoga practice for years. And that was probably the one practice that really stuck to it. And then as soon as this lockdown happened, I needed to dance. And it's like my whole yoga practice has evolved into dancing so much over the past 2 years. And it's like there's this form of expression and liberation that is needing to come through the body and be rooted deep in the body right now.
Yes, yes. I too discovered something more in the body. I think I kind of went in the opposite direction. So I slowed everything right down and just entered pure unknowingness. So simply not knowing what part is going to move next. And I turned to Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen. She's an older lady now, but she really mapped embryology, fetal development, birth, and those early formative years. She was looking for her dance. So she's a dancer. She was looking for her dance troupe to discover new emotions and to bring it to the dance. And so she developed this technique called body mind centering, I believe. But I was just like, oh my God, she's speaking my language. So I wasn't really interested in bringing emotions to the surface in order to entertain others. But I was interested in bringing emotions to the surface, to unravel and unfurl, and not even examine, but to be them, to extend the spectrum of emotional possibility. Not as a form of hysteria, subtle, refined, elegant, new ones, ones that haven't even been born yet.
Yeah. And how alive do we feel? It's like we give birth, we give life back to ourselves when we claim back all of these parts, especially living in feminine bodies. It's like through the movement, we're reclaiming kind of what you were saying, the nuances and the subtleties of everything that's been shamed and oppressed. And it's like when we can just pull that into our body and express it, we're giving birth to ourselves again of all of these parts that have just been like shoved down.
Yeah, yeah. And I really learned how to comfort myself. So in Europe, you know, all the European history started to come up. Wars, tanks, armies, you know. How do I address and comfort that? I've never been in a war. Neither have my parents. So it's coming more from the grandparents. You know, I've been wrapped in a little ball of cotton wool and led a privileged life. And yet, my gut is exploding because I'm afraid I'm going to start seeing tanks in the streets. So I had to find a level of inner consolation and inner comforter, some part of me that can meet that with depth and knowing. Because I didn't want to talk about it. I just wanted to feel it. And I wanted some part of me to meet that and say, yeah, I can feel you're afraid of the tank coming round the corner. You're afraid of someone knocking on the door and saying, hey, where's your pass? So just meeting that with just pure energy.
Right. We don't even need to give it words. We don't even need to give it voice. We can just give it an expression. So going back to the Templars and the 700th year and this coming back again now, I'm curious, what do you think some of their values or their characteristics were? You know, you are living and walking this land that they've walked, and so I'm sure you've gained some sort of deeper knowledge and wisdom about the lives that they led and what they really stood for.
There's so many tales. I'll just share the one that's in my heart. They were kind of like magicians, and I would say even before they were Templars, they had a deep interest in the esoteric. So the original Templars, there were 9 men that were summoned by the Grand Master of Orléans, big city in France, to go back to the Holy Land and search for something. So this Grand Master either felt, I've left something behind, didn't take it on the crusade, or I got a feeling there's something there, and by golly, I want to get my hands on it. So it's interesting, instead of sending his finest Masonic men, he recruited this 9, and he had been tracking and following the development of this 9 since they were almost boys. So they were monks. They were trained in warrior skills. In my opinion, they weren't following the Christian path 100%. They had a little mystical something or else going on. They had an interest, a thirst. And so these 9 were plucked and brought to him and sent on this mission. And they got to stay in the ruins of the Temple of Solomon. They were given carte blanche to dig, make tunnels, and just go ahead, start searching, because this Grand Master had connections in the Holy Land. And they found something, indeed, probably more than one thing. They found what they were looking for, and they brought it back to France. Now, this is the tale that's in my heart, and there is evidence to prove this. They did not take it back to that Grand Master in Orléans. Instead, they swerved and took it to the Cathar bishop, Guillaume, and said something along the lines of, we believe this belongs to you. So could it be the Grail? Could it be some sort of ancestral family tree? Could it be some emerald that was hidden down with the Ark of the Covenant? There's so many speculations. What we can say is it was a highly esoteric, profoundly valuable religious spiritual object. And if you imagine that the Templars are sort of romantically linking arms with the Cathars, that's actually not, most likely, not at all true. Yes, they were around at the same time. Yes, they were aware of each other at the same time, and I would imagine huge amounts of silent respect. But it was more of a parallel path. Maybe they knew not to cross-pollinate because they're both on to something. So if one load get locked down, the other group is still free to pursue whatever it is they're pursuing. So they're there. They're in the background, but they're not fighting the Cathar battle.
And what were the differentiators between the two groups?
Well, they were warriors. Cathars were absolute pacifists. The Templars, as soon as they found whatever it was they found in the Holy Land, that's when they started to be more evident about their worship of Notre Dame, Our Lady, and they were very vague about that. Is it Mother Mary or is it Mary Magdalene? They would not say. It was just Notre Dame. Every cathedral they built or designed or had some sort of input over was dedicated to Notre Dame. Another close connection, another group that's part of this is the troubadours. So the troubadours, they are knights, but their love is poetry and prose and song and merriment. Now, they too did everything for Notre Dame, Our Lady. They spoke of this heavenly lady that could come down and be in the form of their mortal lady that they were courting. So troubadours, courtly love, the courts of love, the Cathars, the Templars, this esoteric romance is just bursting at the seams down here. And that is why the crusade came. It wasn't just the Cathars. The whole lifestyle was like sacred feminine. There was love, there was romance, there was eros, there was prose and literature and art and performance and merriment and nutrition and all the good stuff. And the people were free. This area, Occitania, was shoulder to shoulder with ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Egypt. It was as beautiful and as magical and as esoteric as those old civilizations. But the history books, nothing. We don't mention.
Why? Like, why in the troubadours? Why have they been buried? And everything they stood for, the poetry and the song and the dance and the deep depths of artistry and of the currents that they're connected to that create that, it's just been buried.
Yeah, absolutely. One troubadour stated that Eros, the love coming from Eros, was equal to the love coming from God. That Eros could bless you, Eros could get you into heaven, Eros could wipe away all your sins, you know, old language. Eros is the savior. You want to experience heaven? Eros.
Yep, I believe it.
It was very quickly, it disappeared very quickly after saying that. These people did not care about getting caught. They had something. They had a spirit. They had a fire. They were heretical. They spoke out. They did not care. So they were being sustained by something. I was going to say, in 700 years, we shall return. I am sure that last Cathar was talking about all of it. Not the Cathars, the troubadours, the Templars, the whole way of life. In 700 years, we shall return.
What do you think the women were like? We know that the men were warriors and magicians and holy men, strong men, and in that divine masculine, they were standing up with conviction. What do you think the women were like in that time?
Well, I know for a fact that Catharism drew many women into its fold, and a lot of wealthy women and a lot of educated women. And they became, there's that word, châtelaine. A châtelaine is like a lady of a great house. There was a lot of opinionated women. Think Eleanor of Aquitaine. She wasn't a Cathar, but she was around at that time. So they were educated. They were beautiful. They were wealthy. And they fully stood for their faith. And now they are given the opportunity to speak at the same level as the priests and the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church, something that was utterly forbidden. But Catharism gave them their plateau, their platform. And so there are these amazing tales of how Esclamon de Foix, who's the high priestess of the Cathar faith, was challenging, you know, the local church bishop or deacon. And they'd have these debates about, you know, which tradition is the true Christianity. And these priests could not stand the fact that these women have a voice. Whereas the Cathar faith was just like, go for it. Speak. You have your voice. And so I think that was another big part. That was another driving force of the crusade. the fact that so many women were outspoken and heretical, choosing. So I think it was touching at that, I can never say it right.
Misogynistic.
Yes.
Oh, that one.
It was stirring that old apple cart again. And that's why the crusade was furious. And it wasn't one crusade, it was two. And it was just hell bent on destroying this way of life.
So what time period are we looking at? And how long was the span of the crusades?
Like the 12th and 13th century. Sort of appearing end of the 12th century. Fully powerful 12th and 13th century. So medieval times.
Wow. And some of the customs that they had, the kiss of peace and the feet washing, what were these all about?
My understanding is that the deeper gnosis, like we were saying earlier, there's some things you just can't put word to. You cannot articulate, but we know how to hold it in our body. And we know how to transmit it body to body through the touch, through the eyes, perhaps the odd word spoken in a certain energy. So there was a lot of laying of hands, if you know what I mean. And I believe that that is so classically Mary Magdalene's essence right there. She was the Gnostic. She was the mystic. She was receiving everything at that deeper level. And she knew how to transmit that to the others. She knew how to transmit that into, you know, her inner circle. Who took over after her? She must have left behind a circle of men and women with the gnosis, with the rites and the rituals to get that part across too, not just the dogmatic side of the faith, but the mystical aspect. And so the Cathars, being the spiritual ancestors of that, they had that mystical aspect. And the kiss of peace, you know, it wasn't a kiss on your cheek. It's something that you would stagger a couple of paces backwards after receiving because the top of your head has just been blown off with a copious amount of light. And you know, it's an apostolic line. This goes all the way back to Mary Magdalene, all the way back to Yeshua, maybe further still, ancient Egypt, perhaps. Maybe further still, the original man and woman.
And the feet washing, similar thing, just another symbol of honoring.
Yes, but the old yoga teacher in me says, hang on a minute, feet. And their associative parts with the entire body. Maybe it wasn't just a simple washing. Maybe there was a little bit of acupressure going on there. Tapping out some wisdom, some knowledge, sending it into the body, opening things up in the soles of the feet so that the participant can just receive it more in some way. And the beautiful, merciful gesturing of like pure love. I can't help feeling a little bit of body opening was happening too, and a little bit of soothing and calming the nervous system right down, getting you ready to receive, basically.
So beautiful and so simple, these different ways that they're all like facilitating and nurturing each other's connection and groundedness and healing. Are there any tales of Mary Magdalene as it pertains to the Templars or this region, stories when she was there in particular?
There's a sense that quite soon after the crucifixion and a few others came to the shore of France, a place called Sainte-Marie de la Mer. That's kind of the accepted story. And that her brother was with her. And it could be very possible that her brother was Lazarus. And it's also very possible that this Lazarus later became John the Beloved. John the Beloved has a very similar kind of presence as Mary Magdalene. Even, you know, the studies in the Bible, he's soft, he's gentle, he's heartful. He has a feminine energy. He is also very adaptable to the mystical understandings of things. Peter, on the other hand, you know, he was pretty burlish and a bit of an alpha male. You know, he wanted a nice long list, to-do list, how to do early Christianity. Mary and John were like totally different. So it's very factual that those two, this brother and sister, and a few others, came to France, and that they came to this region first, because this region has always been heretical, even in the times of Roman occupancy, Celtic occupancy. There's something about the French Pyrenees, a little bit similar than the Himalaya. You could say, you know, the veil is very thin here. It's a portal. It's a vortex, something like that. So many spiritual groups sort of migrate at some point to the Pyrenees for a period of time. So I would say while she was young, while she had the spirit, she came here to continue on whatever was happening in the Holy Land. So part two, if you like. So part one, Yeshua. Part two, Mary. After it was well and truly seeded and blossoming and bearing good fruit, then I imagine that she had a feeling that my time is done. The spirit is waning, you know, a bit like my dad. I've done my thing. And then she headed back to Sainte Marie de la Mer and on just a little bit more to Saint Baume near Saint Maximin, where Mary Magdalene's Basilica is. And my feeling is that she left a few years to go into solitude, go into silence. The body is waning. It's time. She's preparing. And she eventually was found in a cave in Provence. And this is the story that France accepts.
And any stories of her daughter, Sarah?
Oh, yes. There's a very fine chance that Sarah, at a certain age, quite a quick age, was sent to Glastonbury. Because a little bit like the Templars and the Cathars, if one gets caught, the other one's beside her. So the best thing to do is to send that little daughter on into the very trustable, capable hands of the High Druids of Glastonbury, where she grew up quite safe, probably being checked up on every now and again by Joseph of Arimathea. And of course, at a certain point, there is a marriage to one of the high bishops of the Druid movement of Glastonbury. And so off goes that bloodline. Beautiful mix. So you have Mary's beautiful priestess blood. You have Yeshua's Christed Sacred Heart. Now you have a High Druid and the Celtic pagan legacy as well. Oh, delicious.
And is there any knowing who this man was?
Oh, no, I don't know. People will know. There is this sense that eventually, a few centuries later, this bloodline was awakened in Merovingian kings of France. So France again, because there's a very big connection between Mary Magdalene and France. So France searches out this bloodline, this royal bloodline, and invites it to the throne. And again, you know, the Merovingian kings were exterminated and got rid of. And, you know, the people of France are waiting for the Merovingian king to take his throne again, knowing full well it's that Davidic Mary line.
Wow. So do you think that royalty, that bloodline that was made its way to France, do you think that in a sense could be the seed point of the philosophy of the French liberty? What is it, liberty, fraternity, egality, or equality?
Well, I think that's technically the three words of the French Revolution. Huge turning point where France said, you know, we will never go down that line again. And it's sort of coming back. That spirit, that revolt is coming back. I don't think those three words refer back to that to those Merovingian kings. But I know it's, you know, it's whispered about, it's spoken about, it's a romantic ideal that the French are kind of waiting for. I am 100% confident this bloodline exists, and it is aware of itself. Some probably more dormant and holding a lower profile, but others being prepared and ready to step in. I don't believe it. I have full faith.
And it does feel like the point that we are at now in 2022 does feel different than the past 2 years. I don't know if you felt that, a turning point we've reached where the fire is burning again.
Yes. From the astrology for this year, 2022 is volatile and big and explosive and huge. There is a sense of a calmer 2023, but not a huge calm, little bit of a calm. But we, if we haven't reached our summit, we're soon going to.
Yes. Well, and literally tomorrow is Pluto return in America. And astrologically, the Pluto return in America, the last time that this happened was July 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence. So this is, I mean, and we know Pluto is like the higher octave of Mars, you know, so it takes that action oriented energy, but it turns it into the transformation, the death, the rebirth, the everything that isn't built from a foundation of truth and love is just, it annihilates it, you know? I mean, kind of like what you were talking about in your experience of going to France, the inner, like anything that wasn't pure and true, it just burned away. Sort of that, what we're going to experience on a collective level.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's going to be something to be seen. Well, it's all the twos, isn't it? It's like 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. And you know, the 22, the 22, that's Mary Magdalene. It's the Masonic number. It's everything we're speaking about in numerical form.
Right. I want to close out asking you about the order of the dove and what that work pertains to and what that means to you.
For me, the order of the dove is, it exists. I've been called to it, and I guess my role is to accept fully its existence. And that sounds very much to me like this land is a mystery school, and it wants people to enter the mystery. So it's not a mystery school as we know it, with guides, you know, human guides, someone watching over you and telling you what level you're at. So my job is to simply take people to certain places at certain times and let them sleep over and just watch over them, mind them, don't say anything. Let this, that is bubbling up at the back of the house, let this inform them of why they were called here. I'm just the driver.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add today? Thank you so much for sharing such beautiful tales and history and the mystery.
I don't think there's anything more. I believe we've really covered good ground, and we've created a beautiful energy between us that the people hopefully can see and feel and hear. And they will know that is a taste of what's coming, of what's here and what's coming.
And what's alive within us now. And sometimes it just takes coming together with one other person to activate that or to remember that or to bring it back online. And I love that you said that, because I think so much is less about the words that are spoken or the knowledge that was just shared, and more about the energy that's created amongst it.
Yeah. It's like the rapport.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I love that word. What on earth does that mean? It's a great rapport.
Rapport.
Oh, that so needs studying more.
Yeah.
And it's huge. What is that? We say it just like that. But it's important when you have a rapport with someone, you've got to look into that. What's being exchanged in the rapport. Is it the kiss of peace?
What exciting times that we're living in. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you so much for following the call of your heart to go to France and for holding these spaces, being the guardians of sacred ground and keeping the mysteries and the stories alive, because it is the stories that bring us back when we've been living through this time of deep forgetting, deep dream spell, whatever you want to call it. It is the stories that connect us back to the truth and to the things that maybe we've always known, but we haven't always known how to say, but have always lived alive in us. And now they're coming alive because they're ready to be expressed. And so the land, the stories, the love, the kiss of peace, it's all pathways back. It's all pathways back. So thank you so much for holding up that little corner of the world and bringing these teachings and wisdom forward.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Thank you for being interested.
Oh, I am endlessly interested. It's fascinating, and nothing has ever felt so true to me. And I'm sure so many people who are listening know this too. They feel it alive in them too. And so for all of us, with the fires burning inside of us, may this just be one little way that we can nurture our flame. Where can people find you?
Oh gosh, one of my phones is going off. You can find me online. My name, AnayaSophia.com. YouTube, got lots of videos on there, Facebook, social media, but probably the website is the main archive. There's a lot there.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Nye. It was so wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you, sweetie. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Ruby Ray. I am your host, Jacqueline Norton, and I'll see you next time.